Today I'm sitting in a little attic room about 100 steps up from an old cobble courtyard with a closely cropped green lawn. It is a small room with yellow walls and a white ceiling and a single leaded dormer window looking out on old buildings and green trees. The furniture in the room is not very impressive. It's been rather knocked around. There is, however, a bookshelf with a series of very interesting books, all of them dealing with English literature. And sitting opposite me is a young man, Mr. Bernard Cousins, and he is a student at Cambridge University, and I am in St. Catherine's College at Cambridge. Mr. Cousins, how old are you?
I'm 23.
And how long have you been up at Cambridge, as they say, a student at Cambridge?
I've been up here for 2 years, and I've got 1 year to do. That's the normal 3-year course for the BA degree.
And this room we're in, it's part of your rooms in college?
Yes, I've had them for 1 year. I shall have them next year because I'm very fond of them. And last year, unfortunately, as with many students here, I was out in digs. These ordinary houses in the town are licensed by the college authorities, and they're inspected every now and again by the authorities. Landladies have to comply with certain rules and regulations. For instance, they have to make quite sure that we are in by 10 o'clock or else the college is notified of the fact. In other words, the rules for us living in digs are just the same as the rules living in college.
Tell me, what are you studying then?
I'm studying English literature. I shall be studying that for the whole 3 years here. When I was in my second year at school, I suddenly found I liked writing short stories. And when I got to my 5th year at school, I was introduced to Shakespeare. I decided that if I was to study anything for any period of time, it would have to be English literature and nothing else.
And so you made up your mind to come up to Cambridge?
Well, no, that's rather different. I didn't. I didn't want to come to Cambridge. My headmaster wanted me to, and so I came.
Why didn't you want to go?
I had 2 years to do in the army, which I was looking forward to immensely, and that got me up to the age of 22, and I rather thought then that I would like to settle down in life and start my job, whatever it would be, and not spend 2 or 3 or perhaps 4 years studying books. At that time, of course, I didn't know much about Cambridge. I thought Cambridge was studying books. I've learnt, even in 2 years, that Cambridge isn't studying books. There's a great deal more to it than that.
And did you enjoy your time in the army?
Oh, greatly, yes. I found that the army helped you to mature and also gave you a rest, so that when you came to Cambridge, although the first year probably had to be spent in wearing off the rust, you were much more prepared for a Cambridge life and for the work you have to do here. And there's also the fact that now, from Cambridge, I can go straight into whatever job I'm getting into, whereas other people coming straight from school are not only stale after at least 2 years here, but they have got the army ahead of them, and they're not at all sure what they're going to do after that.
Yes, what way do you feel that you've matured since you were in the army?
Well, that's very difficult to lay one's finger on, but I can think of myself first joining as what's known as a nignog, and leaving at the end of 2 years, feeling not only that I'd grown a moustache, but that I was somehow much more sure of myself. Most people here are lucky enough to be granted commissions in the army, and when they're put in a position where they have to give orders, where they're left really on their own initiative, it does something to them. After a very short time, they find that they have, I can only say, matured.
Mr. Cousins hasn't, in fact, grown a moustache, apparently, or did you shave that moustache off?
No, I shaved that moustache off because, apparently, people in Cambridge grow beards, not moustaches.
You've done neither now?
I've done neither, no.
What have you learnt while you've been at Cambridge? Have you matured, in fact, since you were at Cambridge?
Very much so, but once again, it's awfully difficult to put your finger on it. I think while in the army, you learnt self-confidence. While you're at Cambridge, you've learned not only self-confidence, but you've learned a toleration that I don't think you'll get anywhere else. For instance, a lot of my friends are from foreign countries. I have one very close friend from Pakistan, another from Ceylon. And when one meets these people and has them into coffee, and when you go into their rooms to have lunch with them, you get to realize that they're just ordinary people like yourself, and that they are maturing alongside you and studying alongside you and rowing alongside you, and you begin to realize that that really is what Cambridge has to offer, this meeting of other people, not just studying books, studying people.
What have you learned from your books?
Oh dear. Well, first of all, when one is learning, one has the TRIPOS examination in front of you, and of course for that, amongst other things, you've got to learn a lot of facts and figures which aren't on the whole very interesting, and I'm sure they'll be forgotten. But when one has to study, for instance, the moralists of the 19th century, if one's own, for instance, religious views are a little muddled, at least one can see what these very fine minds thought about these things. And if one, as I say, is really muddled oneself, it at least gives a pointer, it gives a guide by studying the problems that other people have gone through before you.
You feel that when you came out of the army, you were in fact a bit muddled about something.
Well, I've been muddled about religion anyway since the age of about 14, I suppose, when one begins to think really for oneself.
What way were you muddled?
Well, it's the old trouble of knowledge, and or rather the seeking of knowledge, going against what one has been brought up to. The moralists really answer that one should seek after this knowledge, and the real faith in religion will be found via the knowledge. That I haven't myself yet come across, but I have at least another year at Cambridge, and I'm hoping.
In fact, you are hoping, among other things, apart from your TRIPOS and your degree, you are hoping to get out of Cambridge some understanding of your feelings of conflict or difficulty about religion.
About religion, yes, and really, I suppose this is the same thing about people. For instance, you can't study, shall we say, Webster and Turner and Shakespeare, who themselves must have been very muddled and were muddled at various periods of their careers, without yourself seeing that they went through the same conflicts, very much more deeply, of course, and without feeling that at least you can, by understanding them, understand yourself.
Would you say that this sense of muddle, which of course is really common to all people of your age or even a bit younger, would you say that this sense of muddle had made you unhappy at all?
Oh no, not unhappy, no. I think one is in a way happier to feel that you're getting somewhere, that the muddle is after all only a stage on the journey onwards.
And what is your religion?
Well, my religion is nominally Church of England, but until I've really sorted this out for myself, and I think somehow that it will take several years, I suppose one could say that I'm just still puzzled.
But you hope, and hope was the word you used, to go back, as it were, to the Church of England, having convinced yourself.
Yes, I do, yes. And I think that, myself, is what Cambridge is going to offer me, apart from other things.
Apart from your work and your interest in literature, what other amusements do you find for yourself at Cambridge? You mentioned rowing.
Well, whether one would call rowing an amusement, I don't know, but
sport.
Certainly rowing has, particularly in this term where TRIPOS comes up, that's the examination at the end of the term, rowing not only keeps your body very healthy, but it keeps your mind quite sane too. You see, if those books on my shelves were my constant occupation, I'd go completely mad, I think. But if every day, for at least 2 hours, I'm on the river, rowing, one comes back feeling tired, but more ready, after you've recovered and had some coffee or something, to get your nose into these books again.
We'll go back to the rowing again in a minute, but you say that you feel you would go mad. You don't mean that literally, of course, but you mean that you would find yourself under sufficient tension to feel that you might become a little bit, shall we say, neurotic.
Well, that depends on the person, of course, because after a certain pitch is reached, something, some gyroscope in one, does stop, of course. But there is a great deal of tension when, particularly in this last term, when TRIPOS is approaching, when you have to work probably 10 hours a day, that may sound a lot, but one does, and when constantly the Tripos examination is getting nearer and nearer, and one knows that in a 3-hour exam, one has to try and represent what one has learnt in 2 years at Cambridge, and it's not easy. So when the Tripos is over, all that tension is naturally released in May week festivities, and if people come to Cambridge in the May week and think that undergraduates are quite mad, I think if they remember that they've been through this certain amount of tension, they'll forgive them if they're a little seemingly mad.
You would say, in fact, that it's not only you, that it's a common thing for a student at Cambridge to feel considerable tension during these years of study.
Not so much during the years of study, but during the last term, that is the summer term, when the Tripos examination takes place. And particularly in the last few days before the examination, one can see most miserable sights in colleges of students trying to keep themselves up at nights, working through their set books with wet towels around their heads and lots of coffee on their desks. And there are lots of so-called jokes trying to pretend that everyone is quite happy when everyone really is rather worried and very gloomy indeed.
Do you think that there are students who come up here who find all this too much of a strain?
Unfortunately, there are, yes. I don't want to give a wrong impression because of about, I think, 8,000-9,000 students in Cambridge. One or two do crack up completely. Some just give it up. I'm afraid one or two commit suicide, which is very sad indeed. One of my acquaintance has completely cracked up under it, partly, I think, because he doesn't do any sport.
You think that the sport, in fact, is the great safety valve in all this?
I do, most certainly, yes. And if you get any undergraduate just asking whether he does a sport or not, I think in 99 cases out of 100, the answer would be yes, I do.
Tell me about your sport, rowing.
Well, you've asked that at the right time, because this week is the week of the bumps races. Now, they're called bumps races because each boat has to try and bump the boat ahead of them without being bumped by the boat behind. It's an extraordinary exciting experience, because not only in fine weather in the maze are the whole of the banks all along the, what is it, I suppose, a mile and a half course, lined with rather mad crowds of cheering people, but each boat is followed by its coach and by several supporters on bicycles, and these supporters are waving flags, blowing through whistles. The coach himself has a whistle and a megaphone and a revolver, not to shoot anyone who isn't rowing properly, but to give signals to the people in the boat.
Tell me, is there any actual satisfaction in this process of rowing a boat under these conditions which is immediately satisfying?
Well, after every bumps race, in fact, after every course you do every day, one is so tired that one thinks, I'm never going to row again. But somehow, rowing does get into your blood, and you do go back to it again and again. And I think the answer is that not only you're trying to perfect your own style of rowing, which once you can get anywhere near perfection, which takes several years, you find there is a great deal of grace in it. It's not only your own personal what you yourself can get out of it that way. It's rowing with a team. And to be somewhere in the middle of a boat, and to feel every other man swaying in time, to feel the oars of every other man going in with you, and to feel that you can obey implicitly and instinctively the orders of the cocks, or the orders of the coach, or the particular timings of the stroke, is a very grand feeling indeed.
And does the feeling of exhaustion that you feel after the race ever attack you during the race? Is it ever a struggle to keep going?
Oh, it's most definitely a struggle to keep going, yes. There's a common saying that in the bumps race, one dies once by the gasworks, one dies a second time by Clare Bridge, and one dies a third time at the end of the course, but somehow you usually keep going.
So to this background of study and all the anxiety associated with it, and the rowing, which you find such a pleasure and such a relief from the anxiety. You've had 2 years here at Cambridge.
I've had 2 years, yes, coming straight from the army, and I have one to go.
What would you say if I asked you, how have you found those 2 years?
Well, as with most people, if not all people, when I first came here, I was somewhat lost. As a freshman, one is a freshman for the first year of one's life at Cambridge, I was feeling very strange, particularly during the first term, and particularly because I'd come straight from the army, as do, I suppose, about 50% of the students here. Discipline is one very strange thing in Cambridge. You see, in the army, as you no doubt know, you'll get a notice on a board which says, you will do so-and-so, and you know that you will do so-and-so. But when I came here, I saw a notice which said, gentlemen are requested to appear at such and such a place. And I couldn't for the life of me figure out whether this was merely a request or an order. It turned out, of course, that it was an order. Another example of discipline is the opening address of the senior tutor of the college. He did not say, you will be sent down if you misbehave. He merely said, we expect you to behave like gentlemen. And he then, with rather a nasty look in his eye, reminded us that the waiting list was in any case very long for those people who wanted to get into college and would be only too eager to accept our places.
And how much does all this life cost you?
Well, actually, I have a bill here, which is the bill for the Lent term of 54. Now, the total of this comes to two figures, really. It comes to a total of £39 in one case, which is largely composed of tuition fees, lecture fees, and so on, which is paid directly by the London County Council.
Now, why does the London County Council pay that?
Well, it seems rather queer, of course, that the London County Council should pay a Cambridge grant. But the fact is, London County Council and most local councils, if not all, in England, pay the students a grant if they get to any university from their own particular county. In other words, I got a place at Cambridge by sitting for an examination at a London school. And I also live, of course, in London. Therefore, the London County Council pays my fees while I'm here.
What examination was that you sat?
That was an examination I sat at the end of my school career. It was called a scholarship examination. Now, from that, one can either gain a scholarship and be a scholar here, which entitles you to various privileges, or one can be an exhibitioner, which is a little lower, or one can be the lowest of the low, which I am, a commoner. Most people actually are commoners. There are quite a few exhibitioners, and there is the odd scholar. One of the privileges I mentioned for the scholar is the privilege of reading grace in hall, which only a scholar can do, and is, of course, read in Latin.
So to go back to your bill, I see that it's £52.07 and tuppence, which entails most of the educational cost, so to speak, partly paid by the LCC, and then here's another bill down here, £91.19. That's for one term, and includes everything from university lectures and kitchen establishment fee, and I see fuel, electric light, etc., £4.08 and £4.09. That's an average for the three terms of the year, would you say?
No, that is... Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, that is an average for three terms of the year. This is, of course, only one term's bill. What actually happens, the LCC pay direct to the college such fees as tuition fees, lecture fees, so on, and they pay direct to me £90 a term, I think it is, just under, for a maintenance grant. In other words, if I want to buy books, if I want to buy coffee, they supply the money for that purpose. And this grant, of course, has to last not only for the 8 weeks of every term, but for the weeks, the long months of the vacations.
But in point of fact, your whole of your education here at Cambridge is being paid for by the LCC.
It is the whole of it, yes.
What does your father do for a living?
My father used to be a taxi driver in London. He is now actually working for the LCC. There's no connection between that and the grant, of course.
And where did you go to school, first of all?
I went to school... Well, first of all, I went to St. Martin's in the Field School. When war broke out, I was evacuated and returned to London 3 years after the war broke out to carry on at an emergency school, which is now called Sloane School, somewhere near Sloane Square in London. And there, between interruptions from buzz bombs and V2s, we carried on our work. And from Sloane School, I sat for the scholarship to gain admittance to St. Catherine's.
And you find the discipline here very attractive after the army discipline. But what happens to you if you are, in fact, out after 10 o'clock at night?
Ah, well, I misled you there slightly. One can be out until 12 o'clock at night. The gates here are shut at 10. One has to gain admittance by ringing the bell and waking the porter up. One's name is taken and one is fined, I think, about tuppence between 10 and 11, something like sixpence between 11 and 12. And if one is foolish enough to try and gain official entrance after 12 o'clock, one is, of course, sent straight to the dean, and he can do a number of things to you. He can just, of course, tell you not to be an altar boy and send you away. He can fine you. He can gate you. That is, he can keep you in college for the rest of the term or for any matter of days or weeks that he desires. Or he can more seriously rusticate you. That means he sends you down for a term, and you can't, of course, take your degree at the end of that year, because to take a degree you must have 3 terms residence in Cambridge. So rustication, for instance, for a term would mean that you're really set back a year in your studies, unless you could make up that term in your vacation. And the final, greatest punishment of all, is, of course, to be sent down.
You talked about gaining admission officially after 12 o'clock. Is there any way of gaining admission unofficially?
Well, I hope no dons of mine hear this, but of course, no doubt they, as undergraduates, knew these same entrances and exits. There are always the ground floor rooms. One can tap 3 times on the window and hope that the gentleman inside is still awake. There are certain loose bars on certain windows. There are also certain walls which the army has trained one to climb, even though they may have spikes on top of them.
And have you personally ever taken advantage of these ways of getting into the college?
I think we better leave that question unanswered.
What happens if you're found on the streets, if somebody sees you out when you haven't got permission to be out?
Well, the only people who would find you out there, as a rule, would be the, what we call the university policeman. That is, one proctor and 2 bulldogs. They're not, of course, dogs. They are gentlemen who are probably in their normal life just porters of the colleges, who are dressed up in top hats and bow ties and so on. These prowl the streets at nights, not very effectively really, because most undergraduates after about 3 weeks here know which routes these proctors and bulldogs patrol. But if they find you, for instance, if they find you without a gown after dusk, they will stop you and say, "Are you a gentleman? Are you a member of this university, sir?" And you will then reply, "Yes, sir, I am." They'll ask you which college, take your name, and you'll probably be fined something like 6 and 8 pence if it's a first offence. Not on the spot. You will have to go, say, in a week's time to the dean or to the senior proctor and pay your fine.
You have to wear a gown then at all times when you're out at night. What about during the daytime?
No, the only time one has to wear a gown during the day is on official business, that is, going to a lecture or visiting your tutor or your supervisor of studies. Otherwise, the only other time to wear a gown before dusk is, of course, in hall in the evening, when everybody has, of course, to wear gowns and ties and so on.
Are there any other regulations about your clothing here?
I believe there used to be a lot, but now, probably because of the rationing of clothing during the war, regulations have fallen off somewhat, and one can see all sorts of gay pullovers and gay ties and so on that are worn. But I think, as with everything else, it's left mostly to one's own discretion, and most people don't really want to make themselves look ridiculous by wearing coloured scarves when most other people are wearing a neat collar and tie.
Tell me, we've talked about your work, in studying English literature. How many lectures do you have to attend a week?
One doesn't have to attend any lectures, at least in the English faculty. One goes to one's supervisor in the beginning of the year and says, "What is so-and-so like? Is he any good?" And the supervisor will probably say, "No, he's not. Don't go to him, you see." Or maybe he'll say, "Well, go to this man. He's full of fireworks, but don't try to take notes." On the whole, it is left entirely to yourself. I personally went to nearly all of the lectures in my first year, and I haven't been to any in my second.
You haven't been to any at all since you've been here in college in your second year?
None at all. The reason being that the lecture system is, for me at any rate, not as ideal as it could be. Most of the lecturers, you see, are very famous people who have written books anyway on the subjects they are talking about. And once one has seen them and gained what one can from a lecture, one realizes that the time given to lecturers could more easily and more profitably be given to reading these gentlemen's books. Now, that doesn't apply in all cases, of course, but one has to pick and choose between time spent either working for oneself in one's room or going to lectures. And as nowadays we seem to be much better readers than listeners, most people in the English faculty anyway find that it's much more profitable to them to work by themselves and not to go to lectures.
There's no system of signing on at a lecture. You don't have to keep so many lectures in a year or anything
not
like that.
Not here in the English faculty in Cambridge, no. It's left entirely to oneself.
When you get your degree, what letters will you have after your name?
BA, that is Bachelor of Arts.
And what will you do with that?
Well, I have two strings to my bow, as it were, publishing and journalism.
Which of those do you really think you'll go into?
Well, journalism is, of course, a very hard school to get into. I rather think it would be publishing. Why I've picked both of those is that I do, as most other people here do wish, who are studying English literature, one day to write. And either journalism or publishing, it seems to me, open up channels for creative writing. The word creative, I think, is important because after 3 years at Cambridge, you just cannot go into a job that starts at 9 and ends at 5 and creates nothing.
And do you see yourself in the future as a publisher or as a journalist with anything more in your life than that? Do you want to get married?
Well, yes, I do want to get married, yes.
To anyone in particular?
Well, as you can see, there are several photographs around the room.